Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Spring is here, a time when young men's thoughts turn to, well, I've forgotten. But what I do know is that this is the time of year that CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox thinks about the budget. As you know, last month he surprised county officials by asking for a 15% increase in their contribution to school funding. So this hour we find out more about how he wants to use that money. We'll talk about equity, school security, mental health resources, and more. Dr. Clayton Wilcox joins us for the hour. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to see you again. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Get to WFAE through Facebook or through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can also watch us on Facebook Live. They're coming to get you. I hear the siren. They're coming to get you. Most of the funding for CMS comes from the state. About 60% of the funding comes from the state. And the process for coming up with that figure from the county figure, has always been stressful and, to me, backwards, because they fund you after you have to make the budget, which should be the other way around. But given that, and because property revaluation is coming up and people don't know what their property taxes are going to be, why did you decide that this would be the year to ask for 15% more from the county?
Well, I honestly believe that most of it grew out of just a belief that if we're going to really turn this thing around, we had to ask for what we needed. And then we had members of the county commission in a joint meeting who said, "Superintendent, tell us what you need. We're tired of this incrementalism. When you come back to us and say, we didn't get it done, we didn't close or eliminate achievement gaps because you didn't ask for what you needed." And so I went back to my staff and said, "All right, let's think about what we really need. Let's not negotiate with ourselves. Let's really put forward an ask that we think will help us turn it around." And that's why you saw this increase. We also did this on the heels of knowing that many of the people who ran for county elected office ran so saying that they supported public education, they supported the need to close and eliminate achievement gaps, they supported the need to close some of the equity gaps that existed, and so we thought it was a perfect time to ask.
So this is actually an attempt on the part of this relatively new county commission to change the process of how this has been done in the past, because in the past, it kind of, as I said, seemed backwards, and you had to go back and ask for more, or you didn't get things done because there wasn't the money that you thought there would be, et cetera. So they're trying to remedy this. This is an all-Democratic council. There are no Republicans on council, and outgoing Republicans warned the Democrats, who they view generally as tax and spend liberals, that they'd be watching, and that if they start to become profligate in their spending, then there could be ramifications from voters down the line. If they're going to increase spending, and they've already talked about increasing spending for other things, if they do it for the schools, are they bowing to the will of the people? Is that why the people put them in office? Or are they becoming a little spend crazy?
Well, I think they're honoring campaign promises. I think they campaigned and talked about the importance of education. I think it's really refreshing that politicians put their money where their mouth was. So I look forward to this budget conversation. Do I believe that, you know, the 15% that we asked, which really equates to $69.5 million, do I really believe that we'll get every penny of that? No, I really don't, because there are so many competing interests. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to make sure that we asked for an amount that made sense.
Now, how much did you get last year?
Last year we got about $40 million.
So this is more than double. No, it isn't.
This is about a third again.
About a third again. So you'd add that on top of the $40 million. How much do you need this year in total?
In total, this year we're asking for $69.5 million new dollars. What's really important to note is that when the county funds us, the great majority of what they fund is not specialized program; it's salaries and benefits for our folks. So, you know, with this year, when you take a look at our request, $32.5 million of it is salaries and benefits for our folks.
So the 69.5 is the total budget request. It's not on top of the budget.
Well, it is on top, because right now the county will pay almost 30% of our going forward budget. That's $460 million.
Okay, so hold on. I'm not understanding this. You asked for 15% more from the county commission? 15% is how much?
I have to do some quick math. I think what you take a look at is the county contribution to us currently, and then we've asked for 15% more than that number.
Which adds to 69 and a half.
Which equates to $69.5 million.
Okay. Now I got it.
Okay.
Okay. You're proposing to use, I think, about half of that additional money to fund teacher and staff pay raises. That's about $32.5 million for that. Teacher pay is low, we all know that, but it has been rising. I think the legislature has voted twice or three times in some cases for teacher pay raises in just the last few years. How much more would this provide teachers if they approve it?
We took a look across our workforce, particularly the teachers. For a teacher with 25 years experience, it might make as much as $4,000 in additional annualized income for that person. For a first-year teacher, it's about $2,200, and for a veteran of about 10 years, it's about $2,500.
It's about a 5% pay raise.
That's really what it really equates to, about a 5 or 6%
I don't know the last time I got a 5% pay raise, or anybody that I know.
Well, remember, that's an average number. When you take a look at our seniority schedule from 1 to, say, 30 years, many of the folks will get very little to none. Others will get significantly more. And that's where, you know, people use that adage that statisticians make liars of us all. Because some of our folks will get 2, 3%. Right. Others will get really a very small fraction. This year we tried to weight it so that our veterans got something because they haven't got anything for the last couple of years.
So the average is 5%.
Yes.
That's where the bulk of the raise is. But once again, I don't know when I've gotten a 5% pay raise.
Well, I can't speak to what you get in public radio. I really can't.
Anywhere.
Or in the
private
sector.
I've worked a lot of places.
But I think one of the things that I think you have to take a look at is what the base level of compensation is for our teachers. You know, from a state level, it's about $36,000. And then when we add to that about $7,000, a starting teacher makes about $42,000 in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. To live in the city of Charlotte or to live in the surrounding areas of Charlotte, $42,000 is really not enough to pay for a house, to perhaps have a family, do other things without supplementing your income.
So if this goes through and you're able to do this, how do you parse it out? Who gets what? How do you figure out who is deserving of 1%, 2%, 7%, 5%?
Well, what we do is we take a look at really the experience that our teachers have in the district. We do, obviously, on an annual basis, evaluate all of our teachers. But really what we're doing here is we're taking a look at the supplement schedule that the Board of County Commissioners has supported for all these years. And what we're going to do is put additional resources on that supplemental schedule.
And in addition to teacher and staff pay raises, a lot of these extra dollars that you're asking for, I believe, would go to try and close racial and economic disparities that are reflected in academic achievement. That's from the report that I read. How would that work?
Well, the first thing that we're trying to do is make sure that we have what we refer to as a guaranteed viable curriculum. What that really means is that we're taking a look at the curriculum that we offer kids, what we actually teach kids, and making sure that it is rigorous and that it is relevant. In some cases, we're going to have to purchase new materials. In other cases, it means we're going to have to do a better job of professionally developing our teachers so that they're capable of delivering that instruction along a rigorous and relevant curriculum. So it's a combination of things. It's some purchased materials like a new English series, English language arts series at the elementary level. We want to get back away from that day of whole language to really teaching phonics, phonemic awareness again to some of our earliest learners because we don't think we've done a very good job with that.
Why do we keep going back and forth? I mean, English is English. I learned phonics when I was in the first, second, and third grade, and I know that with math, we started one way, and then the new math came in, which was completely not understandable to parents, and then that went away. Why don't we just teach the way it's been taught for 1,000 years and make it work?
I wish that I had the answer to that. I'd probably be a really...
Doesn't it cost a lot of money to go back and forth and back and forth, and this doesn't... Well, it doesn't work. Let's go back. Isn't that just a waste of resources, time, effort, money?
Well, I think to some degree you could describe it as a waste of resources. And if I could, you know, kind of put my finger on it, I would say that all too often large textbook companies and others who are kind of in the education business.
They want you to buy new books.
I think they drive it. I think legislatures who appropriate resources on a cycle to purchase new materials help to perpetuate that.
Is the state of Texas still in the driver's seat when it comes to textbooks?
Texas and California, I think, are the primary drivers. One of the other areas right now where we're seeing a lot of input into what gets printed is Louisiana, because they've kind of created a gold seal in terms of textbook analysis. While they're not getting the academic achievement that you might think would drive it, they do have some processes in place that textbook publishers are really listening to.
So you spoke a minute ago about wanting to buy new English
language arts
books. How does that address racial and economic disparity?
Well, I think in a number of ways. Number one, I think, you know, and I don't want to get in trouble with friends who are in the civil rights movement, but one of, I think, the new civil rights is being able to read. I think when you look at our achievement gaps, they are largely rooted in the inability of young people to read. So making sure that we have materials that allow all kids, whether you're white, black, brown, rich, or poor, to really have command of the English language.
Well, give me an example of that. English is English. So a C-spot run is the same if you're coming from a household that makes $1 billion as it is if you're in poverty. C-spot run, that's what it says.
Well, C-spot run might resonate with you as a white guy who's of a certain age, but that may not resonate with a young Latino family or young African-American family.
So give me an example of how they can be helped, how a textbook for them would
So be. I think in several ways. First of all, I would say that all too often we've kind of taken a Eurocentric approach to our curriculum. So maybe even something as simple as having pictures in that look like the kids who are actually learning the materials. Okay. Using some of the naming conventions, but also being respectful of some of the things that they bring to us culturally in terms of the acquisition of language, making sure that our libraries and media centers have books that reflect both their culture and the culture that's mainstream that they're being asked to join. So I think there are lots of opportunities like that to really refresh what the materials that we have. You know, Mike, I think you're absolutely on. I mean, you know, our phonemic awareness sounds. Is phonemic awareness the same for white kids, black kids, brown kids? It absolutely is. But in many cases, we don't have teachers right now who are prepared to speak first to a child in their perhaps native language to get them to a place where they're able to acquire English as their second language and move English into a primary place. So we've got a lot of work to do on that.
And you're right. I think it does help if you open the book and somebody looks like you, because that means the story is for you.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about, you know, the achievement gap, but we've also begun to talk a lot about the inspiration gap in the district. You know, to say to a young black child that you can be a rocket scientist, but they never see a scientist, I think that begs the imagination, and it begs the question, you know, can they be something that they cannot see?
Okay. CMS, I was surprised by this, really surprised, that we're the largest, I think we're the largest or the second largest system in the state, is that right?
We're the second largest.
Second largest. Wake is the first?
Yes.
And yet, CMS Charlotte ranks 90th out of 115 North Carolina school districts in per pupil spending. How should we feel about that?
I don't think we should feel good about it. I think when you know, walk the streets of this community, you see a lot of wealth and you see a lot of powerful folks. I think that we should use our collective voice to say to those in Raleigh, we can do better by the kids of Charlotte. We can do better by the kids of Mecklenburg County.
Well, who makes the decision that we only get enough money to be 90th in per pupil spending? Is
I think some of it is a local decision, which we're attempting to correct in this budget request. But I think some of it is at a state decision where they perhaps tier resources so that we're not eligible for some funding that helps other students.
Who's number one?
You know, it's hard to say right now because that number moves up and down.
Give me some very quickly.
So some of the smaller districts are really high up.
All right. Well, when we come back, we'll talk about why we rank so low and what other people are getting when they're at the top of the list. What are they getting for their taxpayer money? We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Clayton Wilcox, Dr. Clayton Wilcox, CMS Superintendent of Schools, is with us, and we're talking about budgets and money, and we'll get into other topics with regard to the schools as we go through the hour. But I mentioned just before the break that we are the second largest public school system in the state. We're 90th out of 115 in per pupil spending. Why do we rank that low?
I think there are a number of complicating factors. Some are funding formulas that reward lower wealth tier schools with more state funds. Some has been, I believe, kind of a local phenomenon of what amounts to a begathon, where we go to the county commissioners and ask for money. But before we do that, we have a negotiation with self about what might be reasonable. And so I think for some period of time, we've not asked for the money that we need to go forward.
Do you think the average parent in Mecklenburg County, particularly a parent in the system, knows that we rank 90th in per pupil spending?
I don't think that they do know that, because quite frankly, I didn't know that until just recently.
Do you think that because you've presented this request for 15% more funding to the tune of $69.5 million from the county commission on top of the money you're getting from the state, do you think that this statistic might sway taxpayers into saying, yeah, I guess we got to ante up?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think there will be some of that, and I think some of that was reflected in the last election, that people voted for people that they saw as being willing to fund education differently. I think people were tired of seeing some of the animosity that went on between the school board and the county commission.
Nationally, whenever I talk to people nationally about education, CMS is always a shining star. They always point, well, you've got a great school system. Mm-hmm. And yet around town, when people talk about the CMS, they generally have lukewarm feelings about it, to put it kindly, unless their child is at a CMS school. That school, they like. Mm-hmm. That teacher, they like. But the system, not so much. And public education in general has gotten this bad rap. If we got the kind of money that you need per pupil to do the job, would that go away? Do you think that money is the answer?
I don't think, though, the money is the entire answer. It is a part of the answer. We clearly have to do a better job of educating kids with the resources that we have. Whether or not we get the $69.5 million, we have to do a better job. But I do think, you know, in the absence of money, we're never going to get there. And so I'm hopeful that the funding that we get is going to help us make a move, because we've got to get into more of a virtuous cycle where people see the investment paying yield.
So in these school systems around the state that are not 90th out of 115 in per pupil spending, that are in the top 10, what are those schools doing? How are they doing? How are those students doing? Are they getting a better education than students at CMS? Do they have more resources at their disposal?
I think there are pockets where kids are doing well. I think right now, even though we take a look at this disparity in funding, the disparity isn't so significant that people are rolling in cash and they're doing great things. You know, when you really look at educational outcomes, CMS is pretty solid. Our graduation rates compare with just about everybody across the state. Our reading levels, quite frankly, compare with just about everybody in the state, particularly when you look at it in terms of growth stores. We're doing a much better job than most of the school districts in the state in terms of growth. When you take a look at us at some of the national indices, once again, in terms of large urban school districts, we're doing really, really well.
Our Cracker Jack producers tell me that Hyde County schools rank first in per pupil spending. They only have 569 students. Wake County, which is the largest system in the state, ranks 97th. I should move the show up there and have this conversation there.
I think Kathy would welcome that conversation.
They must be appalled. So I don't know what stage the budget is in or the budget requests are in, but I know that you are having community workshops on the budget. I think one's tonight at Mallard Creek High School and one April the 11th at Crown Point Elementary. What's the focus? What's the purpose of those meetings?
Well, we really want to share what we're asking for and let people know. For example, one of the things we've not talked about is that we're doing a lot of work around trying to improve the lives of some of the support team members. You know, we're moving up to a minimum wage of about $13.22 an hour, $13.62 an hour, which is a major increase. But we want to also then share that you don't just raise the bottom and not push the top because you get into compression issues. You devalue experience in some cases. But we also want people to know that we're being very conscious about market rates, that we don't want to overpay for a job that in the private sector you yield only a certain income. We want to share with the community what we want to do in terms of this guaranteed viable curriculum and the adoption of new materials. So,
what is that? You've got $4.3 million guaranteed to a viable curriculum. What does that mean?
That's really making sure that across the system we're able to say that Math 1 is Math 1 is Math 1. It's making sure that our English language arts program has a constant set of materials that all kids get to experience as opposed to just some kids getting to experience. And that's really what that money's for.
And the $21.8 million that you've set aside to fund investment in people, is that what you were talking about just a second ago?
Yes, that really is. That's saying that, you know what, we know, for example, that our custodial units. Right now, if you take a look at our custodians, they're cleaning about 30,000 square feet, which is 4,000 or 5,000 square feet beyond the industry averages. So we're not only going to improve pay for some of our custodians, we're going to add additional custodial units to the mix.
Let's move on to some other topics here. $4.2 million in that budget is set aside for school security. The system has gotten infusions of money in the very recent past, I think more than once, to beef up security. How much has that added up to in total, and how much would this additional $4 million be used?
Well, all resources, all in, we spent about $10 million in the last year on school security, and that does not include about the $6 million that we pay for school resource officers to the city of Charlotte, to the city of Matthews, and to the city of Cornelius. We are looking to increase the number of officers in this budget, although there is some discussion on our board about is that the wisest use of our resources. We're looking at improving our camera systems, our electronic surveillance, if you will, and we're looking at adding additional panic cards so that every teacher in the event of emergency can summon assistance. So that's where we're really looking to go this year.
You've been conducting random searches periodically of certain schools. What is your impression of the impact of these security searches?
We've now conducted, I think, 19 different searches at a majority of our buildings. Some we've actually hit twice just by the luck of the draw. We've not found any life-threatening weapons there. We've found a couple of tasers. We found some other things. Generally, I think it sends a message. I'm not quite sure what I think of the message, but we have seen a bit of a downturn in some of the behaviors that we were looking to ameliorate.
Well, you said you're kind of lukewarm on this, which surprises me, because back in January you said that wanding students, which is where you run that wand that they do at the airport,
yes,
on people, is a gross indignity, yeah, but needed for safety. It's my impression from a 30,000-foot angle that students are driving this request for safety. They want to feel safe, and they've seen what happened in, yeah, these other situations, and they want you to do this stuff. Do they feel that it's an indignity to get wanded?
I don't think so. I think what I've seen is our students actually kind of stand up to attention.
Yeah.
They don't give us a hard time about it at all. I absolutely believe that students want to be safe. When I said it was a gross indignity, what I really was saying is that we would even have a gun culture that people would see in our schools, that we've not been able to address this from a policy standpoint at either the state, federal, or local level. You know, I had kids say to me in this conversation around Butler High School that it was easier for them to get a gun than get to the public library. That's a gross indignity, that we don't have adequate gun policy that would keep these guns that are doing harm away from our schools.
You were planning to screen an entire school at one point. Has that happened yet?
We've not done that yet. We've done an entire building on a campus, but we've not done an entire school.
How do you make the decision of who gets screened and what kind of screening it will be on a weekly or a daily or a monthly basis?
We put everybody's name in kind of an old-fashioned apothecary jar, and we have a minister or somebody come over so that we're not accused of picking the school. They reach into the jar, they pull out a handful of names, and then that's where we go.
Some have advocated metal detectors, and we've talked, I think you and I have talked before, and I know we've certainly done have conversations with reporters on this program about metal detectors. It would slow down the process of getting in almost to a crawl. We'd be all day getting into the school. Has that idea been completely abandoned, or are you looking into maybe portable metal detectors that would be set up at every school entrance of a building on one morning and move to a new school on another morning?
I think our thinking has really evolved on that. I think what we're thinking about, if we would do something like that, and that's a very big if, we would probably use it as part of the random search where we'd pull a classroom out, have kids walk through the metal detector, perhaps be wanted if we came up with something. Right now, what I'm really excited about is that we have purchased a gun dog. That dog is going through training right now, much similar to our drug dog. This dog can smell gunpowder. It can smell cleaning solvents that are used around guns. It can smell a gun that's been shot within the last couple of hours. And that dog is going to be making random searches here yet this spring. That's going to help us a lot because that dog can be released within a building and go through that building in a matter of moments, so we won't have to do some of these traditional, more intrusive searches.
Wow. What's left to do in terms of hardening campuses in the CMS system to the point where parents and students and teachers and staff can feel relatively, you will never be completely safe, but can feel relatively safe?
Well, I think we have to continue to build relationships with kids. I think we have to continue to add social workers, guidance counselors, and others to our rosters. I think this request to add additional security consultants is on our campus is an important part. We do have some things like locks and doors that we have to do. Yeah, we have to harden some windows so that they're not easily accessible. We've got a little bit of fencing that we have let to do. I think, Mike, for me, security is going to be something that we just have to do all the time. We have to be vigilant. And it's going to be a variety of things that we're doing to keep our kids safe.
When you got into this business, I don't know how long you've been involved in education, but you started as a teacher, as most superintendents do. When you got into this business, did you ever think that school security would take the spotlight?
I never even dreamed in my wildest imagination we'd be doing this kind of stuff.
And this is another example of a societal problem that has been put on the backs of the public schools.
Absolutely. It's one of those things that consumes a lot of my time every day. I'll tell you, late in the night actually is when I do a lot of thinking about school security, because you wonder, what if, are we prepared? What do we do? I never thought that I would be spending a great deal of time. I never thought that I'd be dealing with issues related to border and customs enforcement. I never thought that I'd be dealing with homelessness. I never really thought that I'd be dealing with hunger that is so perverse that kids can't think straight. Right. But those are the things of a modern-day superintendent.
Wow. Let's talk about guns in schools. CMS reports that the number of students bringing guns to school fell by half last year compared to the previous year. We found some guns in school this year. Is the trend going up, or are we at stasis? Where are we?
I think we're really kind of at a new normal where we're going to find guns from time to time on our campuses, and that's a sad comment. But I think right now we're tracking 2 years ago, so that we may have a little uptick over last year. The good news is, other than Butler High School, every gun that we found has not been fired, and students have told us that there's a gun on the campus. So I think there's an awareness. We have a new campaign out that I think is going to really take root and maybe change the culture a little bit, and that's I Can, Guns Can't. We're really excited
it's
about
that. Social
this.
Media and poster campaign, is that right?
Primarily social media, but there will be some posters in schools to draw kids' attention to it. This is a place where kids can celebrate the things that they can do that, again, guns can't.
In the 2016-2017 school year, CMS found 19 guns at schools, including 3 elementary schools. How do kids in elementary school get their hands on a gun that they can put in a backpack and bring to school?
I think you have to ask their mother or father that question. It seems to me that they're not taking care of gun security.
And why are elementary school children bringing guns to school? What's the point? What do they intend to do with those guns?
Well, I don't think, in the cases that I know of in CMS, those kids didn't intend to harm someone. But they wanted to show off they had something that was really kind of forbidden. It was really taboo. So I think we see that a lot.
It's show and tell.
I think it is show and tell. And I think the other thing is in a couple of the elementary ages, they were actually a pellet pistol or a starter pistol as opposed to, say, a 9mm.
So 19 guns found on campuses in the 2016-2017 school year, 9 guns in the 2017-2018 school year. You may have said this already, but I'm going to ask again. How many guns so far this year?
So far, I think we're right around 9 or 10 this year.
All right, so that's why it might we'll probably go up a little bit. So how does a social media campaign aimed at changing attitudes about guns and showing students ways that guns don't have to define their lives, they can define their lives in other ways. How does that work, coming from an adult organization like CMS? Do kids listen? Do they pay attention? Are they reading this and taking it in?
I think you have to go where kids are. I think so. That means that we have to go to Instagram. We have to go to some of the other social media platforms that kids use. I think they see it. They pass it on. It's almost got to become their campaign as opposed to our campaign. So we have to kind of pollinate, if you will, the idea patch and then see where it goes.
When did that start?
We've started this Guns Can I Can about 2 weeks ago. We'll continue through the spring, and hopefully it'll be a piece that sticks with us.
Too early to tell how it's doing, what kind of impact it's having?
I think it's too early, but we've really seen some neat things where kids are able to use the app and actually start to talk about what they can do. And so we're starting to see some kids engage with the platform. I think that's a positive thing.
You're also proposing to put 20, I think it's 25, school resource officers in elementary schools. And one of the board members, Carol Sawyer, says she doesn't believe more resource officers in those schools will make them safer and would rather see those 25 positions be deployed in supportive roles rather than policing roles. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I understand exactly what Mrs. Sawyer is saying. There are other board members who feel differently. Personally, we put them there not just because of the threat of gun violence, and I think we've not done a good job of explaining that to our board members yet. We will at an upcoming budget workshop. But, you know, we have all kinds of issues that take place at elementary schools, custody issues. We have issues of that are happening in nearby proximity to our elementary schools that require us to go on a lockdown. It'd be great to have armed presence there just in case that spilled over onto our campus.
So resource, I'm an old person. Yeah. A resource officer is a school policeman.
A school policeman.
And they are armed.
They are armed. They are armed. They're a traditional policeman from CMPD.
How many schools have them?
Right now, all of our high schools and middle schools have officers, and a couple of our high schools, I believe four, have two officers.
And you want to put them now in elementary?
We would like to. I think that, you know, the other piece of that is that, you know, oftentimes young people grow an irrational fear of police. I think knowing police officers early can help that.
Is this happening all over the country, or is this an urban school system problem?
I think it's happening all over the country.
All over the country.
I think it's happening.
What should that tell us?
I think it should tell us that we've got to do a better job as a society making sure that schools are sanctuaries and that, you know, parents have to be parents.
I mean, did you ever think when you – I'm going back. Did you ever think when you got into this business that every school needed a policeman with a gun?
No, I never thought that, nor do I really think it today.
But you got to do it because you got to be safe. You can't be safer than sorry.
Yeah, you have to be. You absolutely have to be. Yet I know there are people who will cite research that an armed officer has not stopped a school shooting yet.
Right.
But having them there more quickly may reduce the carnage.
Dr. Clayton Wilcox is our guest. He's the superintendent of CMS schools. So much more to talk about, including equity, economic mobility, ICE, race relations. Hope we get to all this in the next 20 minutes. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Clayton Wilcox, CMS school superintendent, is with us today. In early March, it was revealed that North Carolina lawmakers, some lawmakers, proposed to pay teachers more if they chose to carry a gun. It's part of the School Security Act of 2019, which includes active shooter drills, school lockdowns, and security changes. And they would be offering these teachers who are willing to carry guns a 5% pay raise. Where does this idea stand?
I think there are still some in the legislature who are talking about it. I think there are some who would love to see it come into fruition. Myself, I think it's bad public policy. I think it is just the wrong thing to do. It has nothing to do with my belief about guns, but it has everything to do with my belief that adding more guns to an already volatile situation is absolutely the wrong thing to do.
And what kind of – how would – is there anything that could be done to make you more comfortable with this? I don't know what you've heard from parents or teachers or staff about this. What have you heard from parents, teachers, and staff about this?
Well, from the teachers, I've not heard a positive word about carrying a gun from a CMS teacher.
So would there be any kind of particular training that these people would get that would make you feel comfortable that if they were armed in a classroom, a tragedy wouldn't occur because of that? An inadvertent tragedy wouldn't occur.
The answer to that from me is a no. I don't think that a teacher could be trained well enough to respond in that moment of tragedy. I think the unintended consequence of putting a gun in a classroom that's already volatile creates the possibility for a lethal confrontation between teacher and student or between student and teacher.
Or just being in the line of fire.
Absolutely. I think there are just so many things that are wrong with it that I could not embrace it, and I would hope my board would not embrace it.
Okay. Before we move on to other topics, Fred emails, ranking 90 out of 115 by itself is meaningless. What is the comparison in terms of dollars? Wouldn't one expect large systems to rank below small systems on a per pupil basis?
I think that is true. I think that, you know, the way the funding mechanism was set up is to help some of the smaller districts who didn't have the resources to better be able to provide the services to their kids. And I did say early on in the program that, you know, the disparity between the number one ranked school and the number two ranked school or the number 90th may not be that great in the overall spirit of things. But I do think there is something to be said about the fact that in a community as wealthy as Charlotte, given the challenges that we face, we probably ought to rank higher than that. And maybe it's because of a local contribution. Maybe it's because of rethinking how the state divides money up. Again, I think it's a conversation we have to have.
Let's talk about equity. You've said that CMS students need investments in equity. Define equity.
I think equity is, you know, we know not all of our kids begin the race at the same place, and so we have to help some of our kids, provide them with some of the background experiences they need to be successful in school. So equity to me is really giving kids what they need, not giving kids the same. You know, I've said a lot that the greatest inequality in this school system is to treat everybody equally. You know, if you took a look at my kids who have traveled the world with their father, whose dad makes a reasonable salary.
And who has books in the house.
Who has thousands of books in the house, actually, not only children's books but adult books, who have two parents, one mother who can be there both before and after school because she does not have to work. She chooses not to work. I think they have a great advantage over some of the other kids. And so in some ways we have to help overcome some of that.
So it's not just about leveling the playing field in terms of making sure that every teacher is equally equipped or that every school has textbooks and pencils and notepaper, et cetera. It is catching people up and giving them, not just catching them up, but giving them an experience that of the world that they may not get outside of the classroom.
Well, absolutely.
How do you do that? You can't take every kid to Europe.
No, you can't. But I will tell you, in a day of modern technology, it is possible for every kid to see the Louvre. It is possible for kids to see things that they've not seen before. You know, my kids went to the Smithsonian. My kids went to a number of places where they got to see some of the federal documents that have defined our history. A lot of kids can't do that here in Charlotte, but now they have access through the internet to seeing those things.
Well, didn't they have access to that through television for the last 50 years?
You know, I don't know that.
And movies?
Well, yeah, if you accept the version that Hollywood is telling a true story all the time, or if you accept the version that everybody has access to cable television or back in our day over the air broadcast, if you accept that what you get is accurate and factual, then yeah, people have had access. But even then, you know, I know this growing up in Iowa, this is, will date me a little bit, but we had to go to my grandparents' house during my early years to watch television because we didn't have one.
Okay. Is this what you mean by wanting to break the linkages between student achievement and economic status?
It is. I think all of us know that there are some members of this community who need extra assistance. That doesn't mean that we're giving them a hand out. It does mean that we're giving them a hand up.
And you've reported that white students in white students in low poverty schools have the best chance of getting the best teachers and getting out with a degree that leads to a college education and a diploma there as well, whereas blacks and Hispanic students at high poverty schools are left behind. Not news. We've known this for years. Haven't we been trying to change that?
We have been trying to. But, you know, I'll tell you one other thing, Mike, that people don't see in the study, and it's there in black and white. It's that white kids in schools where there's a high incidence of poverty also don't perform as well as white kids who are in schools that are relatively more wealthy. So there is an impact here of what poverty does to families. And that's where we begin talking about this income gap. And again, I'm not here to advocate that everybody makes the same thing. I'm simply here to say that, you know what, we acknowledge that fact, and then we have to help overcome some of those challenges.
And the school board recently approved a policy that calls for ways to measure and monitor equity in schools and to focus on aspects of equity that can be documented: student assignment, educational opportunities and expectations, student wellness, school facilities, human resources, family engagement, etc. Is this the first time that we have monitored and measured these things?
I don't know that it's the first time, but I think it's a really important step for this board, and I think they should be commended for the deliberative process that they put, because what they're trying to do is look at what are things that matter in the 21st century. And that's something that I think all too often got lost in this conversation. This board really struggled with some really difficult issues. You know, they're not about counting the number of pencils in a classroom. They're not about counting the number of workbooks that are available to kids. They're talking about things that really matter in the 21st century.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just said I think they should be commended, and yet there have been some who have said they're too slow. I think this is a tough process. I think it took the time that it took.
Is CMS, is the school board, are you developing the policies and procedures to make this happen, or are you taking them from other school districts where they've already done this and they've discovered that it works or it doesn't work? In other words, are you using best practice, or are you just kind of making this up to see what happens?
Well, I hate to say that we're making it up, but
Developing your own policies.
So we are looking at what's working in other school districts, but quite frankly, a lot of school districts aren't getting this right. So we're working really hard behind the scenes. When we start talking about a guaranteed viable curriculum, that's not new to Charlotte, but I will tell you, I don't know that anybody who's done it really well. And so we are trying to say, how do we do it better? You know, when you take a look at the board's policy, that's their role to set policy. It's my job as their superintendent to implement that policy. So I'm writing procedures and practices. It's why you see we have a new strategic plan that's directly aligned to a number of other seminal documents that are going to guide our behavior. It's why our budget requests can be tracked directly to our school improvement projects across the system.
We've been talking for years also about ensuring that the quality of a teacher is not connected to the school that they're in. In other words, we've been trying for years to make sure that students have access to the same resources and the same quality teacher no matter where they are. We have not necessarily been successful. How is this going to be different?
Well, I think that through some of the professional development that we're doing, by the hiring that we're doing, but, you know, I think all too often some of our teachers get a bad rap because of the neighborhood that they work in. I mean, I'll give you an example. If you take a look at that one of the third highest performing school district in terms of creating growth for kids, it's in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. It's Geringer High School, the third highest performing school district in the state in terms of getting growth for its kids. That's not what most people would think about Geringer High School today. That says to me that there are great teachers at Geringer High School. So those who say that Myers Park or Providence has a hold on great teachers, yes, they have some very good teachers. But that's not to say that there aren't great teachers at Geringer, too.
What does growth mean? How do you define it?
Growth means that we begin by taking a look at where kids are with a pretest, and then over time we look at a post-test or an end-of-course exam, and we talk about how far the kids came in a year's time.
Sarah emails, is there a plan for increasing equity of instruction for gifted students across the district? Will the district change how allotments are determined for gifted ed, talent development, teachers, et cetera, in schools, in each school?
We're looking at all of our allotment formulas, but right now there is no plan to change the allocation for talented and gifted teachers. But it is something that we look at on an annual basis.
The Leading on Opportunity report was recently released. That comes out of the Economic Mobility Task Force that came as a result of Charlotte discovering that we are 50th in the nation in terms of economic mobility. And I'm going to go over this again for people who are not aware of it. If you are born poor in Charlotte, chances are you will die. If you stay here, you will die poor in Charlotte because your chances for economic upward mobility is pretty much nil. And that shook everybody up in the community. They're trying to make the policies that will address that and change that. They recently released the report that was 2 years in the making, aimed at improving this track record. You were at that meeting where they outlined 21 different strategies to help improve our record, and they said it would take about 15 years for these recommendations to have an impact. Is that fast enough?
It's not fast enough. It's not urgent enough. We're trying to break that cycle today. And I will tell you, we have an urgency about us and what we're doing. You know, one of the things that we were challenged to do is to create more opportunities for kids to gain industry-based certifications so they were employable sooner. When I got to this district, we had about 400 kids that were in those industry-based certifications. Last year, we had over 4,000 kids get industry-based certifications. This year, we're on track to eclipse that record. So we're working hard because I don't really believe that our kids today have 15 years for us to get it right. I think what that report was saying, and I am on the Leading Opportunity Council. I'm one of the 17 members of that group. What we're trying to say is that there are systems of practice that have to change. That's going to take some time. But there has to be some real urgency around the day's events. I know that when you take a look at what CPCC is doing with their opportunity scholarships, they're trying to break that today for kids.
Are they on the right track with their 21 strategies?
I think we are on the right track with the 21 strategies. I think each of them viewed independently, people might take some exception to, but when you take a look at them in the totality, I think they will change outcomes for Charlatans.
And do you think, within CMS at least, that you can move this along more quickly than they say you can move it?
I absolutely believe we can move it along more quickly.
Because it's going to take 15 years. Why? Because you have to start at 7 years old, or is it based on the age of a person? Well, how is it? What's it based on?
Well, I think it's really based on kind of generational change. That you know, outcomes for folks don't happen overnight,
right?
And that if you talk about moving from poverty to a greater degree of wealth, that's going to take some time for you to do that, particularly if you don't have the skills right now to move.
So, is education the biggest component of this?
You know, it's interesting because I sit on the panel. We meet every month. As I listen to things, I think education is the heart of it. I think education is the centerpiece of that. I think what we do here in CMS, what we do with our charter school partners, what we do with the private and parochial schools matters hugely.
And does that mean then that money is part of this too? You can't. Could you do what you're being tasked to do and what this report says that would like to accomplish in 15 years or less unless you are fully funded to the point that you say you need the money?
Well, I think we absolutely need additional resources. That's why we made this ask of $69.5 million is because we are on our way towards changing the way education is delivered.
Could you do it the way you're funded or have been funded in the past?
I think we were perfectly organized for the results we were getting, so I think the answer to that is no. I think that's why you see a reading block deficit in the system is because we didn't adequately fund, nor did we adequately organize around the topic.
Well, your budget proposal, I'll go back to that for just a second, also seeks county assistance with the impact, these are your words, of charter school growth. How have charter schools... Well, you project 1,552 new students in charter schools at a cost of $6.2 million. That money's coming out of your budget, right?
It does come out of our budget. Overall, we'll spend about $60 million on charter schools this year. The challenge for me as a school superintendent is not charter schools in and of themselves. It's the funding mechanism, because here's what happens. I pay money out for a service that is being provided, but I don't get the incremental reduction in my expenses, so it comes at a cost. Mm-hmm. The kids don't leave in nice, neat packages of 25 when they go to a charter school. but I still have the resources to support those kids, but I don't lose the cost. That's really the challenge that I face.
Okay. Earlier this year, you said that students were stressed, anguished, and sleep deprived, and you were talking about undocumented students or students that come from undocumented immigrant families with the ICE crackdown that was going on, and you said that you would be providing resources to principals and teachers and families. What did that consist of, that support?
Well, first of all, we said to all of our kids that we support them, we support their families. We talked to our principals about, you know, how they would interact with ICE. We talked about legal resources that were available, not just to our principals if an ICE agent showed up on their campus, but about legal resources that we could distribute to kids. Again, we are going to abide by the nation's laws and rules, but we also believe that the schoolhouse is not the place to perfect some of that.
We have 10 seconds. There's going to be another teacher march in Raleigh later on this year. You supported the last teacher march. Are you supporting this one this time?
I think I support what the teachers are trying to do. I think they have to give voice to the issues that are important to them.
Clayton Wilcox is the superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, the worst job in the world. I think that's my words, not yours. Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.